This week, Brother Scott Duvall takes a stab at the answer behind the real problem with progressive lines. It's not always what we think, like putting somebody who's ill-prepared to go into the East. It goes a little bit deeper, and he brings a fresh new perspective. Then, we'll hear the most comprehensive and truthful overview of the forget-me-not flower. We all know that the popular myth is a myth, but Patrick Day gives us the real story behind all of it in a complete look at its history, and he leads us to the conclusion of perhaps an inconvenient truth. And in the end, should we still wear it? Stay tuned to find out. All this and more.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 582. I want to thank the producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast for all of their financial support in making this program happen. If you're curious on how you can help be a part of this production, please head on over to our website, wcypodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see your options. We've also got a shop and a bookstore that runs through Amazon affiliate links. The shop is, of course, personal items that come direct from me to you, so a little bit different there, but nonetheless, all help support this program. So I have to once again apologize for not getting the episode out on time. You know, the problem was that I had 3 weekends in a row that were booked, and I had to complete regular work in the midst of the week as well, so it got a little hairy. And my intent was actually to release what I'm releasing with this episode earlier on Friday, and then to give you another episode, but it didn't work out, so I'm releasing this one Sunday/Monday, and we will have back on a regular schedule moving forward. We are all done traveling for at least the foreseeable future, for a little while anyway. So I want to thank the Valley of Michigan for having me out for the Northeast Winterfest, which happened on February 18th. It was a wonderful time. I got to meet awesome new brothers, and congrats to the new members of the Valley of Michigan. I have to say, I saw the new 20th degree. It was pretty epic. We watched the film. You guys know that I'm not about like these movie DVDs, but if they're going to be there, they have to be amazing. And I will tell you that this was really great. It was as good as the new 4th degree, which if you read something I wrote a little while back when that had dropped, it was fantastic. It was part of the original story. It did really well. And I think the 20th degree was also done very well. And before that, I was out at the Masonic Week event for the Allied Masonic Degrees. I want to wish Brother Clyde Schoolfield a happy retirement in the role of secretary as he moves over to the role of treasurer. And I want to congratulate Brother Seth Anthony of Pennsylvania for taking on the Grand Secretary role for the Allied Masonic Degrees of the United States of America. Before that, I was out in California doing the Illumination Lectures, and I want to thank everybody who came out for that as well, and obviously to thank South Pasadena Masonic Lodge for all of their hospitality. Now, I was really excited. Just a week or so ago, Brother Scott S. Duvall, an emeritus contributor of the Midnight Freemasons, decided that he was in a position to write a paper for the blog, and he had been thinking about a journey to the East in his appendant orders, and he had some great thoughts on this, and I'd love to read this paper for you now, with the promise that in the future I will have Brother Scott on the program to talk a little bit more about this paper and what it meant. So here we go. The Real Problem with Progressive Lines by Midnight Freemason Emeritus Contributor Scott S. Duvall. This is hardly a new topic. Many have written about the shortcomings of the progressive lines. They advance members poorly suited for leadership. They advance members who lack the skills to address the specific needs at that moment in time. They almost always advance members who are too new to the world of Masonry. I tend to agree with these criticisms, though I also see some advantages to the progressive line. However, these shortcomings do not address the main problem with the progressive line, which is they place complete emphasis on the end goal. Servant leadership should be much less about reaching the top position than it is about the journey to that top position. I recently laid out the timeline of the years I would reach various presiding chairs, barring any abrupt shifts. I want to make sure that I'm around to watch my kids grow up and participate in the quintessential experiences of their childhood. But I recognize that each organization has events that are essential for the leaders to appear at and support. There are some organizations that would be so demanding of my time that I would need to miss key events if they overlap. You might say family first, but that would be detrimental to many organizations, and that is the commitment to short-term sacrifice officers make up front. As I looked at my timeline, the time to reach the ultimate position in many bodies is significant. For example, the Rose Croix line in the Valley of Chicago has 7 progressive officers under the Most Wise Master. 2 years at each chair means that a typical commitment is 14 years until one reaches the presiding seat, even longer for our Lodge of Research. Much more than the 6 years the average Mason in my state takes to reach the East. My first thought was, that's a lot of time to wait in the wings. Consider how often we hear from an outgoing leader, I wish I had more time, I was just getting started. Perhaps the time to be building your organization is now. Now is the time to work with each of your officers and craft a cohesive vision for the future. What is stopping you? The concept that the master has the final say? In essence, this is my way or the highway. It's precisely this attitude that I posit is the larger problem with progressive lines. That is the assumption that I won't offer any value until I am the top leader. You might say, sure, you offer plenty of value. You should be volunteering and supporting the master's plan. This is derivative of the same problem of focusing only on your chance to quote-unquote run the show. In my experience, this often means silently follow along so you don't get removed. This is certainly not productive and may not be Masonic. Imagine if businesses believed that only the C-suite executives, CEO, CFO, CMO, etc., were positioned to speak up and affect change. In the progressive system, neither the superiors nor inferiors are encouraged to learn and grow. The organization fails to establish recognizable continuity. When the progressive line encourages one to sit on the sidelines, it doesn't encourage anyone to learn much about the needs or potential of the organization. One's early years working in any organization are spent learning how to function, where to find answers, and how to recognize problems. You are a hen, an apprentice. You build rapport with colleagues who are going to move up with you. You learn to ask for help, pitch ideas, and build a common vision of what your organization could become. The leaders in a progressive line commonly chart their own course without soliciting any feedback. Where in history has a single idea been presented and taken as the best path forward? A community of diverse thinkers is much more likely to drive positive improvements. In our professions, many of us work on teams, challenging each other's assessments and solutions. Then we present those to our leaders who repeat the process and prioritize projects for the goals of the organization. I'll admit that I am beginning to see more inclusion from our top leaders. But given our unfamiliarity with such inclusion, we often don't know how to respond. A tangential result of this solo leadership is individuals expect everyone to fall in line simply because they hold the gavel. I'm certain we have all seen this. The progressive line has taught that only he with the microphone gets to speak. It has failed to reinforce that it's more often the rhetoric a leader pushes through his microphone which excites members into falling in line. In Illinois, our installation reminds us that, quote, it is not by the strong arm or iron will that obedience and order are secured, but by holding the key to the hearts of men, end quote. Over years of watching new officers move into the top seat, I have developed an even more significant concern. Giving full latitude to a single person fails to establish continuity. There is no consistent strategy or vision, just a series of abrupt course corrections year after year. Oddly enough, this should be the strength of the progressive line and a glaring weakness of every other approach. It isn't. One should learn to conform to the collective vision and strategy as you climb, while seizing opportunities to modify and craft that vision along the way. You learn to employ tools such as rhetoric and empathy to establish a strong reputation that offers you opportunities to inform policy and modify tactics to strengthen the organization. We need to be evolving the way we approach Masonic leadership. We have important gifts to offer to humanity that require all hands on deck to build. As leaders, we should be looking for ways to prepare future leaders to build the vision we presently hold. And, as a subordinate officer, we should be engaging our leaders more. As I think about the next phase of my service to Masonry, I want to spend my time fully engaged. I recognize that I have something of value, just as each of you do, to offer over an extended period, not just a year or two as the head honcho. Quite frankly, if I wait to craft the future of our fraternity, it will be too late. I will not affect any changes in those final years, and once I'm in the past position, it's no longer my ship to steer. Scott Duvall. So I love this piece because it encourages us as subordinate officers to take ideas to our leaders, not just to take their directions and push them forward. I also love what he says here about a constant shift in direction year over year as Grand Masters change. This is on the extreme level. But it's so common that it's almost comical. I remember one of my secretaries once told me, "Grandmasters come and grandmasters go." And that certainly is the case. So again, I promise to have Brother Scott Duvall on the program soon to talk more about this. I got to get on his schedule. I know he's a busy guy just like me, so we'll see when we can schedule this out and make sure we get him on the program. Next up, let's get into this all-new Masonic Mythbusters with worshipful brother Patrick Day.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal, occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
In the past 40 or 50 years, and probably longer, the forget-me-not flower has become a quasi-official, unofficial symbol for Freemasons. Many brothers wear it as a lapel pin because, let's be real, there are some obnoxiously garish and large Masonic lapel pins. And the forget-me-not is a much more subtle, smaller pin to wear, especially on one's suit when, say, going to work and you don't want to scream at the world, "I am a Freemason!" I actually used to wear one of these pins because I like the subtlety. And there's a story that accompanies why the forget-me-not is counted among the symbols of Freemasons. It is a secret sign among Masons in Germany during World War II to recognize each other because Hitler had made Freemasonry illegal and had served as a quiet protest against Hitler and fascism. I also like that because I also hate fascism and the systems of power that generate fascism, so I really like wearing the pin. However, is this true? Is the forget-me-not really an emblem German Masons adopted to recognize each other under Hitler's oppressive regime? Truth be told, everything is way more complicated than that. Feel-good story you were fed, and consequently, it's not really that feel-good. So let's start at the beginning and work our way back to the National Socialist Party, i.e. the Nazis. I will use those two terms interchangeably. Nazis, National Socialists, because they're the same thing. Forget-me-nots are little light blue flowers native to Europe, Asia, and the Americas. They have five petals with a yellow center, but the center can also be pink, white, or even blue itself. The petals are a little furry, a little fluffy, so they are called myosotis, from the Greek for mouse ears, and that's what they have usually been called, mouse ears. There are some regions that will call them scorpion grass, and others that call them forget-me-nots. They're the same thing. There are a number of stories as why they are called forget-me-nots. One story is that God was walking through the Garden of Eden and asked the flower what it was called, to which the flower sobbed, "You don't remember my name?" So God called them forget-me-nots, so as to never forget them again. I thought God knew everything. Why would he forget the name of a flower? Anyway, I've also come across this story, but with Zeus instead of God. I can only find this story in its variations as early as the 1900s, so it appears to be a folk origin story of very recent history. Another story is that a German knight in the Middle Ages asked his beloved what she wanted, and she asked him for some of the flowers from across the river. So he swam across, fetched some of the flowers, and drowned while swimming back. As he was drowning, he tossed her the flowers and asked her to not forget him. Thus, those flowers became called forget-me-nots. This is actually not an old medieval legend, but rather it comes from a 19th century Scottish poem. In March of 1879, Scottish poet of Irish descent, William McGonagall, pens a poem called Forget-Me-Not, which he later published in 1891 in a collection of poems called Poetic Gems. McGonagall is mostly known because his contemporaries thought he was a bad poet, with some of his poems being called, quote, the worst in English literature. And his poems are rather childish, overly simple, and lack any notable depth, but he didn't care, and he just kept composing, so good on you, Willie. In this poem, Forget Me Not, a knight, no nationality indicated, named Edwin, is walking along the river with his bride, Ellen. She tells him that she doubts his love, but to confirm his love for her, she asks that he go to the other side of the river to fetch her some of the lovely flowers that grow there. And he did just that, but he drowned on the return swim and cried, O heaven, hard is my lot, my dearest Ellen, forget me not. For I was ever true to you, my dearest Ellen, I bid thee adieu. As he tosses the flowers to her, she cries and says, Edwin, dear, hard is our lot, but I'll name this flower Forget-Me-Not. One thing to note is that there is no description of the flower in this poem. Nothing that ties it to the Myosotis flower. There is also no geographical indication that might tell us of what kind of flower it is. There is one species of Myosotis that grows in Scotland, the Myosotis alpestris, or alpine forget-me-not, which is also the state flower of Alaska, because it does well there. This could be the flower McGonagall intends, but such is speculative, as I can find no information on this, when this flower began to be called forget-me-not. One might surmise that such flowers, or at least some flower, was already being called forget-me-not, as McGonagall doesn't appear to be imaginative enough to invent such a name for such a story. Or maybe he is, because it's really not a very imaginative poem. The point being, at some point in very recent history, likely in the 19th century, a certain small blue flower began to be incorporated as a symbol of remembrance. Flowers at this time had a lot of meanings, and whole messages could be sent using a bouquet of flowers arranged in such a way according to the various flowers' meanings. One can imagine the Myosotis flower might be one such example. Now, how did it become an emblem for Freemasonry, especially German Masons, during the rule of the National Socialist movement? To be honest, this gets into complicated and not entirely understood history of Freemasonry in Germany, thanks to the Third Reich. But it's not really the Third Reich's doing, but rather German Freemasons who contrived the history and even changed Masonry to suit the National Socialist Party's agenda. So let's take a brief look at this history. About a decade after the formation of the Premier Grand Lodge of England in 1717, Germans started going to England to be initiated as Masons. The first lodge was founded in 1737 in Hamburg, but it was not under the jurisdiction of any Grand Lodge until 1743, in which it applied to be under the jurisdiction of England. More lodges would be founded, and strangely, multiple Grand Lodges. And in 1749, the Provincial Grand Lodge of Hamburg was founded. In 1741, the Mother Lodge of Frankfurt and the Grand Lodge of Upper Saxony were founded. And the Mother Lodge of the Sun and the Grand Royal Mother Lodge were founded in 1744, the latter to be renamed the Grand National Mother Lodge of the Three Globes. Maybe it's not that weird that multiple Grand Lodges appeared in Germany, because let's face it, Germany is a very large country. There are, after all, 50 Grand Lodges, actually 51 Grand Lodges in the United States, plus Puerto Rico. So, yeah, I guess it's not that weird. Anyway, we'll skip over the Rite of Strict Observance and other similar important events and movements in German Freemasonry. Many more lodges are founded, and more Grand Lodges are formed. They all have different opinions of each other, some recognizing each other and others not, and being recognized by foreign Grand Lodges and not. In 1880, there began an attempt to unite all the German Grand Lodges into one Grand Lodge, but the different Grand Lodges were split over recognition of the Grand Orient of France over the Grand Lodge of France. A sort of federation was made of the Grand Lodges, which was very loose and fragile, but during World War I, the three old Prussian Grand Lodges and the Grand Lodge of Saxony left the accord. One point of contention and major distinction between the nine Grand Lodges in Germany was over the Jewish problem. The three old Prussian Grand Lodges did not admit Jews, only Christians. The other six Grand Lodges did admit Jews and Christians alike. These six Grand Lodges became known as the, quote, humanitarian Grand Lodges, but largely due to their participation in distributing aid from England after World War I. There are estimated to have been about 70,000 Masons in Germany in 1930, with two-thirds of them belonging to the three old Prussian Grand Lodges, and the other third belonging to the other six Grand Lodges. Now, all that is highly abridged, I will admit. It is vastly oversimplified, but it suffices to understand that there were multiple Grand Lodges, and that they did not all agree with each other. And the ability to unite all German Freemasons was a delicate matter. This is extremely important to understand, because German Freemasons will have differing opinions and affiliations when the Nazi Party emerges, especially when Hitler comes to power. And the different Grand Lodges and their members would be treated very differently. Thus, German Freemasonry cannot be treated as a monolith. It is highly diverse. So when the story of the Forget-Me-Not is told, when they begin by saying, Freemasons in Germany, I understand that not all German Freemasons were the same. Not even close. And as we will see, a great many of German Freemasons were sympathetic to the Nazis. Now, finding any impartial and objective research on Freemasonry in Germany during the Third Reich is difficult. This is because many German Freemasons were ashamed of what they supported and their actions during this time. So they tend not to speak of these things, or they clean things up a bit. Which might be a good PR move, but after the war, but to someone like myself, I don't appreciate it. I want to get to the bottom of what really happened. Now, I'm going to be relying heavily here on Brother Alain Bernheim, 33rd degree. Bernheim is, he's French-born, but now resides in Switzerland. When he was 12 and living in Paris, he was arrested by the Gestapo while France was under the occupation of the Nazis. He saw the occupation of France by the Nazis, and he is very knowledgeable in German Freemasonry during and between both the Great Wars. Thus, I will be very reliant on his work, as it is quite solid. Here I'm going to be working from an article he wrote for Phil Lathes in February of 1997, an article entitled German Freemasonry and Its Attitudes Towards the Nazi Regime. If you're a member of Phil Lathes, go on their Dropbox and pull open that article. It's very informative. I highly recommend it. On January 30th, 1933, Hitler becomes Chancellor of Germany. Almost immediately, the six humanitarian Grand Lodges voluntarily dissolve or went dormant. This is in response to the Enabling Act on March 23rd, 1933, which basically gave the Chancellor and his cabinet the ability to enforce laws, even to the extent of violating human rights, without approval of the Reichstag. This more or less made Hitler able to act without the Reichstag to keep him in check. With such unprecedented power and the six humanitarian grand lodges knowing his and his cabinet's views on Jews and Freemasonry, figured it would be best to just dissolve their grand lodges and the lodges under their jurisdiction, and the membership they're under. Understand that many Masons under these six grand lodges were openly resolved to oppose Bolshevism, Fascism, National Socialism, and the extreme Christianity that was taking hold of Germany at the time. But even they knew when the game was up and it was time to throw in the towel. What of the three old Prussian Grand Lodges? They did not admit Jews, so they should be good, right? No. No, and they knew that too. Firstly, they tried to make good with the Nazi Party. One record from March 30th, 1933 is in an Essen newspaper. Tells of the Three Globes Grand Lodge sending a congratulatory letter to Hitler himself, though it was likely ignored. These three Prussian Grand Lodges attempted to rebrand themselves, seeing as their membership largely sympathized with the National Socialist Party's ideology. The Grand Lodge Royal York of Friendship changed its name to the German Christian Order of Friendship. The Grand Land Lodge would change its name on April 23rd, 1933, to the National Christian Order. This was not a light decision on their part, one record calling it, quote, a gloomy day in the history of the order. But a decision that was, quote, the last desperate attempt to save the order. Following this, it was ordered that, quote, the rituals and catechisms were revised anew. Likewise, the Three Globes Grand Lodge would change its name to the National Christian Order of Frederick the Great. They would even issue a declaration that acknowledged their Masonic origin, but now distances itself and withdraws all affiliation with Freemasonry and Masonic ideology. Quote, although our order originated historically with the Masonic Grand National Mother Lodge of the Three Globes founded by Frederick the Great, the following points differentiate us from Freemasonry. 1. The rejection of any ties with foreign bodies. 2. The rejection of any member within our ranks who is not of German origin. 3. The rejection of secrecy concerning the custom and fixture of our order. 4. The rejection of anything un-German in the symbolic cult of our order. End quote. On April 12, 1933, the following was stated in a letter sent to the National Socialist Party in Munich by the Grand Master of the National Christian Order, Frederick the Great. Quote, during its almost 200 years of existence, our order has constantly refused to admit Jews, and their request for admission was constantly rejected. We believe that there can be no reason now to refuse the admission of our members into the National Socialist Party. We are not Freemasons. Open the door to 20,000 patriotically minded men who wish to take part in the edification of the National Socialist country. End quote. That same day, the following was issued to the membership itself. Quote, we are not Freemasons anymore. This must be said immediately by each member of the order to every person who is not. For the time being, changes to the ritual of the first four degrees consist of the following. And here he explicitly and openly states a number of secret Masonic words, passwords, etc., because they're no longer Masons and therefore no longer held to their old oaths. So he replaces them with this, I continue, with light, people, he lives in the sun, faith. In the Master's legend, Solomon's Temple is replaced with the German Cathedral and Hiram with the architect, end quote. These new rituals and ritual changes were approved in September and October of 1933. Only one of the six humanitarian Grand Lodges, that of the Grand Lodge of Bayreuth, encouraged its lodges to continue to meet, but 6 days later they voluntarily dissolved and reformed as the Society for Culture and Knowledge, and this strictly prohibited Jews from their membership. Some of its former leadership encouraged its former lodges to seek recognition under one of the new Christian orders, though few did. In January of 1934, all Freemasons were prohibited from joining the Nazi Party unless they recanted all obligations to Freemasonry, as the Christian orders had done. Those Freemasons who were already members of the Nazi Party were permitted to remain, but would not be given promotions. On July 16th, 1935, all three of the Christian orders were compelled to dissolve. Only one Grand Lodge of the original nine survived. That of the Symbolic Grand Lodge, which was formed in 1924, would be reconstituted in exile on November 15th, 1933 in Palestine. I actually can't find much on this Grand Lodge in exile, but it appears it went dormant or extinct shortly thereafter. Now, you may have heard something like that German Masons would form and hold lodges in concentration camps. Truth be told, the only known lodge to be formed in Germany during the Nazi rule was in 1943 by Belgian resistance activists in the Esterwegen concentration camp, and they called themselves Cherished Liberty Lodge. But these were Belgians, not Germans. Now, after the war, many British and American Masons would form Masonic clubs and other loose associations of Masons, as well as some military lodges, and this helped to reform many of the old German lodges that were dissolved or defunct. On January 22nd, 1949, the United Grand Lodge of Germany would be formed. While the Grand Lodge would argue that none of their members took part in any Nazi crimes, it should be noted that several of their prominent members were also former members of the Nazi Party. They may have not been, like, directly executing Jews and Romani people, but they certainly were part of a party that authorized such. In 1945 and 1949, the Masonic Service Association of North America sent delegations to Germany to report on the Masonic situation there. They were headed by Ravi Denslow, past Grand Master of Missouri. Here I will quote Bernheim's article, entitled, "The Blue Forget-Me-Not, Another Side of the Story." Quote, "The report signed by Denslow and Dietz proves that American delegates received biased and incomplete information. It did not mention once the Symbolic Grand Lodge of Germany or the Supreme Council of Germany, both founded in 1930, the only German Masonic bodies which openly resisted Hitler. Nor did it mention the declarations of the Prussian Grand Lodges which openly supported him in 1933 and 1934. It depicted an imaginary German Freemasonry too weak to resist the Nazis and forcibly dissolved in 1933. That information, which reflected the agreement to forget the past, mostly originated in Theodor Vogel. Had the American delegates been more fully informed of the attitudes of most German Masons in 1933, I presume the report would have been different." End quote. Why was none of this openly shared or discussed after the war? Well, if you've ever talked to children of Germans who lived during the war, one thing they will tell you is that as they got older, they began to ask their parents what they did during the war. And they noted that their parents usually dodged the questions or fell eerily silent. I imagine many Masons were ashamed of what they supported and condoned during the war. Further, there was a paper written and read by Elich Howell in June of 1973 before Kortekoronati Lodge, in which it unabashedly discusses the reality of German Freemasonry during the Third Reich. The Grand Lodge of England would actually censor the publication of this paper in Ars Cortecoronatorum, number 86, that year. All that read in the proceedings concerning this paper was, quote, "The United Grand Lodge of England, for reasons best known to its rulers of the craft, refused publication to this article," end quote. It would eventually be published almost a decade later in issue number 95 in 1982. So, even long after the war, the situation of Freemasonry in Germany was considered sensitive, and censorship still occurred, even outside of Germany. So it should be abundantly clear at this point that German Freemasonry at the beginning of the Third Reich was not a monolith, and it cannot be viewed as a whole. Many German Masons sympathized with Hitler and the Nazis, while a minority would be opposed to the National Socialist agenda, but would later give in and either dissolve or flee the country. And when Freemasonry came back to Germany, it was oftentimes under a forget the past doctrine, which is kind of ironic. So now, on to the forget-me-not. The oldest and most commonly iterated version of the story of how the forget-me-not became a Masonic emblem goes as follows. With the National Socialist Party now in control of Germany, it became apparent that they would not allow Freemasonry to continue in Germany. The square and compasses would be too obvious of a symbol to wear. So in 1934, the Grand Lodge of the Sun in Bayreuth adopted a more subtle symbol, a little blue flower, to adorn the lapels of brothers who refused to let the light of Masonry die in Germany. That way, if the Gestapo asked what it was, they could just say, a flower, pure and innocent. In reality, this story really only circulated amongst the American and Canadian Grand Lodges, and appears to be derived and fluffed up a bit based on Denslow's report in 1949. Now, as David Boyd points out in his Phil Lathy's article of April 1987, quote, "While the Gestapo was sometimes clumsy and inefficient, it is unlikely such a symbol would have long remained unknown, unless it was employed sparingly," end quote. And this is a good point. We know there were approximately 75,000 Masons in Germany in 1930, but approximately 50,000 sympathized with Hitler, being members of the old Prussian Grand Lodges. We only know that the symbolic Grand Lodge openly opposed Hitler, but their members amounted to about 800 Masons. Even giving the benefit of the doubt to those not of the Prussian Grand Lodges, their numbers were about 25,000 Masons. But imagine 25,000 men going about, all with the same lapel pin of a blue flower. Even if it was just 800 men with this lapel pin, it seems suspicious that the Gestapo would not eventually take note of this and suspect something was going on over the entire course of the Nazis' rule. So is there any merit to a German Grand Lodge creating a forget-me-not to distribute to its members? Is this even remotely true? Well, yes. Kind of. The Grand Lodge of the Sun used to make lapel pins every year for each delegate. The annual meeting in Bremen in 1926 did have a pin distributed depicting the forget-me-not. These pins were manufactured in Selb near Bayreuth. This was not an attempt to replace the square and compasses. Think of it more like a grandmaster's pin, if your grandmasters do that. They certainly do that here in Colorado, which is distributed to members of that jurisdiction for that year. Those pins do not replace any symbols of Freemasonry. They're just nice little tokens of being present at the annual communication. Strangely, and perhaps by pure coincidence, the Nazis would hand out a forget-me-not lapel pin in the winter of 1938. And as it would be expected, it had nothing to do with Masonry, because Masonry was abhorred by the Nazis. Why would they pick a Masonic emblem? In 1933, as part of their annual winter relief efforts, the National Socialist Party would hand out a token in exchange for a donation to the relief of German citizens during the party's rule. This was called the Winterhelferk, and was part of Hitler's plan that no one should go hungry and no one should freeze. Of course, that only applied to non-Jewish Germans. When one made a donation, they received a token of thanks, and these varied year to year. I've actually seen one of these in person. It was a ceramic medallion depicting something on it. I can't remember. It was old and really worn down, and that was like years ago. But I do remember the guy who showed it to me, his asking price was $1,200. Yeah, people still collect these things. And I did not like that guy. In 1938, this token was a forget-me-not pin. Curiously, this pin was made in the same factory in Selb as the one the Grand Lodge of the Sun handed out in 1926, and likely used the exact same mold. However, let's be clear about two things. It was illegal under the Third Reich to wear any badges or regalia that did not originate from the Nazi Party. This forget-me-not likely would have been worn by many non-Masons, but doubtful to be continued to be worn after the winter of 1938. Second, German Freemasons are a lot more secretive than American Masons. They are not as keen on wearing lots of Masonic regalia and rings and what I like to call jingle jangle, as American Masons do. Ever met a Mason wearing so many Masonic lapel pins that he jingles when he walks? Yeah, jingle jangle. German Masons, prior to World War II, they also did not have huge, impressive meeting halls in the middle of downtown. They're usually more austere of Masonic emblems, and they tend to just have like a small square and compass somewhere near the door. In fact, I do not actually know of any German Masons who even wear forget-me-not, even today. And as has been noted by David Boyd, even in the decades after the war, the vast majority of people wearing the forget-me-not are Canadian and American Masons, but few, if any, Germans. In 1948, a new German lodge was established in Selb, which actually adopted the forget-me-not as part of their lodge jewels. The Grand Master at the time, Theodor Vogel, remembering this story about the forget-me-not pin, commissioned a large quantity of those pins to be made, since the factory still had the original mold, and thus, they handed them out. We know a lot of this thanks to Ernest G. Geppert, who in 1961 accompanied Vogel when he handed these out. Geppert would write a letter detailing how much the usual story of the forget-me-not was way wrong. He would close the letter with the following remark. Quote, "You might perhaps at some time choose to adjust your version to the factual one," end quote. Apparently his remarks didn't stick. Regardless, it appears the old story continued and still continues to circulate. And admittedly, it's complicated. And no one likes complicated stories, which is like a straightforward story. Bernheim would quote Boyd, and I think this is worth reiterating, quote, "The more you dig into any facet of Freemasonry, the more you inevitably find. Unfortunately, it often happens that what you find may be difficult to prove or downright untrue. The story of the forget-me-not is just one such case," end quote. Sure, in 1926, some Masons wore the forget-me-not. And in 1938, some former Masons likely wore it again, but as a Nazi emblem. But it was never worn as a secret sign of recognition. The story is likely born out of a need to suppress the past, cover it up, or simply not acknowledge it, and replace it with something a little more feel-good. But people wanted to know what it was like to be a Freemasonry in Nazi Germany. So some narrative had to be created. No German Masons wanted to say outright, "Yeah, we totally renounced Freemasonry, changed our name and rituals, and sided with Hitler." And the strange reality is that the only Grand Lodge to openly defy Hitler, symbolic Grand Lodge, is not mentioned in any of these narratives. And of all their lodges, only five would join the United Grand Lodge of Germany at its formation. Bernheim estimates that only 1 or 2% of German Freemasons actively opposed Hitler. None of this bodes well for the usual Masonic tale of the forget-me-not. Now, I guess this needs to be asked. Does it really even matter at this point? Really, does it matter at all? So many Masons love this story. I know several Masons here in Colorado that love to tell that story and present a forget-me-not to all newly made Master Masons. They just love it and they eat it up. I suppose if the point of wearing the pin was to state that we as Masons actively oppose fascism, then sure, great, let's do it. I hate fascism, so I'm on board. But we're not really wearing it in memory of all the German Freemasons who suffered under Nazi rule. That's just not the case. Perhaps in memory of Jewish Freemasons who suffered under the Nazis, but strangely, and the usual tale of the forget-me-not is that Jewish Freemasons are not mentioned. Actually, nothing about the Jews who suffered are ever told in that narrative. Jews are totally absent from that narrative. Rather, it's all about the German Freemasons, and that is just incorrect, since most renounced Freemasonry and signed up with the National Socialist Party. So, should we continue to wear the pin? Eh, keep it. I think at this point it's impossible to remove. It's adored too much by the brethren. But just know that that story is way more complex than is presented and vastly skewed to erase much of what German Freemasons did not want to own up to at the time. But if we just say that we wear this pin in memory of the oppressed and that we openly oppose fascism and any faction of oppression, then that might be more suitable. Of course, in that case, I would prefer to just openly say it out loud. I oppose fascism and all structures of power that permit fascism to arise.
All right. That is probably the most comprehensive and most interesting look at the entire situation that is the forget-me-not pin. I have read countless articles about how amazing this pin is, and then I read countless articles that really did a pretty decent job of allowing me to understand really the truth behind it, and it is kind of an inconvenient truth, it seems. Now, I agree with Patrick. Let's just keep it around. Maybe we can just rebrand it. But we also are doing ourselves a disservice by consistently promoting the same old tired rhetoric that we know is just false. I want to thank you all for joining me this week. I encourage all of our Craftsman Plus to talk about the episode in our Facebook group. I'll put a couple of question prompts in there. Maybe we can solicit some interesting conversations from you all. Again, I want to thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners. If you are interested in helping to produce the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out our options. Recently, I have to mention that the Scottish Rite Northern Jurisdiction took notice of some of my leather work, and I sent them one of the pieces to as a giveaway, and they are giving away a field guide for the Pathfinder program. I was very honored to have been able to donate that for the drawing, and if those kinds of things are interesting to you, certainly you can reach out to me. Check out the website Skull and Crown LTD, as in limited, .com, and you can see some of the various product offerings that I'm putting together. There are some things that are coming soon, but are not on the website just yet, but will be updated very soon. So that's it. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you all next week, and until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.
That's it. Here's your...